Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of The BIP Show is brought to you by Brookside Energy. Brookside Energy, one of the most exciting oil and gas companies listed on the ASX, is about to capitalize on record high oil and gas prices. With an existing solid production base and the first of over 20 planned new wells nearing production, Brookside Energy is about to join the ranks of top-tier Australian oil and gas producers. Brookside Energy, working with local communities to ensure sustainable growth and value creation through the safe and efficient development of energy assets. And now, on with the show. Hello, you're listening to The BIP Show. BIP is for business, investing and policy. That's what we're here to talk about. Don't forget to hit subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Paul Colgan, director at CT Group, and I'm here on the line with James Whelan, investment manager at VFS Group. How are you, James?
How are you now, Paul? Fantastic day here in Sydney, and really looking forward to this podcast ahead, mate.
That's right. Sun's out, guns out. We are recording this on Monday, August 16th. About half of Australia is still in lockdown. This week, we are going to do a deep dive on the economics of the part of the economy that is hit hardest by all of this, hospitality. Our guest is one of Australia's most acclaimed chefs, now known around the world, after appearing on the global Netflix hit The Final Table. He trained at the Maclay Street Bistro and later in France before he ran one of the most awarded restaurants in Australia, Mark in Sydney, until he sold it 5 years ago. He now does TV, has ventures on cruise ships, works with various high-end global hotel chains. He was once an electrician working on mines in WA, something I'm sure that would make a great episode of The BIP Show on its own. But he's a guy with diverse interests, as you'll see from his Twitter profile, at Mark Best. And he's also an avid photographer. But he's here to try and explain the economics of restaurants, which, as we'll see, reach right across the Australian economy. Mark Best, welcome to The BIP Show.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. Look, let's get right into it. Thousands of restaurants in Sydney and Melbourne are shut down. What is the impact going to be? How is this going to play out for the industry?
First of all, I'd like to put myself up as the Nostradamus of the industry in that I'm very, very happy not to own a restaurant. I can tell you that there's nothing that has more outgoings than a restaurant. So while my income is paltry in comparison, cash flow, certainly my outgoings are manageable.
If you're running a restaurant at the moment, like, what does it look like?
Look, I was trying to be positive, but dire, I think, is the word that I would say. Look, this has been something that's been coming for us for many years. We're talking about an industry that has had diminishing returns and increasing rate of attrition in terms of people coming into the industry. And with COVID has just brought that into the spotlight, and there's really, really nowhere to run.
Yeah, it's incredibly tough for them out there. If you can maybe talk me through how you would envisage, and I'm sure you talk to a lot of your industry colleagues about this, but what's involved in shutting down a restaurant, and then how easy is it going to be for them to open up again?
You're talking about your daily operation shutting down?
Yeah.
Look, it's very difficult. I mean, at Mark, which is a fine dining restaurant, typically it would take 4 days between shutting down and restarting. That was just the process of preparation, etc. Obviously, with a simpler food offering, that there would be a lesser time, but I would say it's a 2-day minimum, but plus the weight, the waste, etc. I mean, you're talking about you know, an industry with very little economy of scale, mostly for most of the operations. And so the actual costs of shutting down and then reopening are enormous and would, you know, put your profitability behind for the month, way behind, and it'd be very, very difficult to catch up. And that's the issue, that increasingly it's becoming harder to catch up, and the amount of debt these operations are incurring, it's going to be difficult to deal with.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the things is a lot of them are kind of like small family businesses, right? They either run off either a long-standing relationship with a bank, or, you know, as is not uncommon for them to be financed out of a, you know, a family mortgage or something. So that's going to be inflict a brutal cost on these people. Have you been talking to owners lately about, you know, how they're feeling? And
yeah, sure. Like, even like, you want to talk about a marquee chef, a marquee brand like Neil Perry, for whatever reason decided to jump back into the fray. He's a bit like the Brer Rabbit of the restaurant industry, you know. He can't stay out of the briar patch. And but, you know, he's while he was able basically to cash in towards the end of his career by selling the Rockpool Group, he's now reinvested his own money back into Margaret and Double Bay, $4 million evidently, and has yet to be able to open, and unable to open into the foreseeable future. So while you say we have a relationship with the banks, I mean, the relationship seems to only go one way. And while you have enough collateral to sustain that relationship, they'll support you. But there is a point where they don't.
Yeah. And the other thing is the people. So all these, you know, fantastic people that we come across when we're dining, you know, front of house staff, you know, wait staff, all that kind of stuff. They're, you know, if you have regular places, and I have one or two, you know, you kind of get to know these people and everything, but, you know, I haven't seen them now for months, some of them, and, you know, kind of worry about them. But obviously, you know, the prospects are not good in the short to medium term. Are people, you know, starting to leave the industry? Would they be thinking about doing that?
This is the thing about maintaining those relationships. I mean, a lot of the, you know, smaller operations are basically just doing takeaway just to maintain some income. But a lot of it is about keeping their staff engaged, because what's happening is that when you're closing down, you're finding that less and less of your staff are coming back into the workforce. So over this time, I was talking to, you know, several leading restaurateurs, and they're just noticing that so many people are not coming back into the industry. So each time you shut down for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, you're having less sort of human capital coming back. It's really difficult.
And that's sort of what I wanted to go just on the actual operations. And thanks for coming on the show as well. It means a lot. Just talking about the logistics, I'm the guy who always wants to know about the operations and the actual structure of doing things and running a business, which it, as much as it's making food and making people happy and bringing such immense joy, it is still running a business at the end of it. Mm. And we're seeing now with happening in Sydney now, and this is an anecdote because we need an economist on to tell us the actual bare bones of it, but I'm seeing that a lot of places that sprung back or even managed to do the takeaway service during the last lockdown, at this one now, they're just gone, and they've just said that's it. We're not opening. We're fishing until pending notice, or they've just disappeared. In Melbourne, I'm not sure that the numbers there on this time around are what they're going to be about people who are just going to say, you know what, this just isn't going to happen. At what stage does it become a, you know what, the Band-Aid has been torn off too slowly, and it's time to just go and tear that off? Is there a number, a numeric area that's sort of in that with staff, or has it just become, look, it's in your heart and it's just not time to go?
It's a big question you're asking. So just to try and unpack that, one of the one of the things that you're sort of alluding to is profitability. The profitability of takeaway model is spurious. You're working with basically an industry that was happy to work on a national average of 4% net profit.
Yep.
And accountants and other businesses would laugh at that type of thing. I mean, it's barely profitable. It doesn't take much more than a strong wind or rainy day, let alone a pandemic to wipe that out. In terms of takeaway, while the first round of shutdowns was supported with JobKeeper, I've spoken to a lot of people, a lot of restaurateurs who said that basically it was a pretty good time actually, and that people were spending like drunken sailors in terms of the wine list, etc. They had money in their pockets. This time around, they've a noticeable decrease in spend, significant, up to 50% less. So obviously that's the issue. And I think as COVID fatigue has set in and the numbers continue to grow and the Delta strain becomes more prevalent and more easy to catch, people are more wary, etc. So the economics of running this takeaway model are diminishing. I think some are still doing very, very well. I see they've nailed the offering. Others were unable to engage their community with the offering that they had.
So if you were called upon to consult about a place in the reopening trade, and this is again unplanned off the map here, so I do apologise, but I think you might be able to handle it. If you were called on to consult for a restaurant that was looking at what they were going to do through the reopening, would there be any advice that you've got on that about how they're supposed to be reshaped or refashioned?
Look, I'm basically it's a dream crusher, so because as soon as someone asks me about opening a restaurant, I tell them not to do it.
Don't do that.
It's the only rational response. After that, we're just talking about hopes and dreams, so.
I've got I was just thinking about that 4% margin. I have a very good friend of mine who, anytime someone tells him, oh, look, I'm thinking of quitting this and just going away and opening a little cafe somewhere, that he said, all you're doing is going and buying yourself a wage and making your work at it. That's it. There's no amazing dream of having the one place that's going to be, that's going to make you money the entire time. All you're having is just somewhere that'll just keep you paid with a bit of bookwork and you can do what you love, which is the important thing that's in there. So,
look, everyone has a business plan, et cetera, but most of it is driven by, unicorns and rainbows. And and even if you look at my career such as it is, I mean, I'm at the end of my career and I don't own my own house, et cetera, because that was, that was on the line. That was what held up and propped up my career. So, yes, I did buy myself a job and an illustrious job and some celebrity, but I'm thinking at this end of my career, perhaps the cost was too much.
Wow. Yeah. It's rough. And I'm sure, Mark, there's a whole bunch of your industry colleagues who are wondering the same thing. And it does make me think about, maybe 2011, 2012, from my personal experience, this is just a survey of one, but that was kind of like the peak of, White Linen Dining in Sydney. And lots of great restaurants started to slowly fold over the following years. And then Mark shut down, Neil sold Rockpool, and things have become, maybe its taste drove it a little bit, and things became much more sort of, the good restaurants were much more mainstream, if you like, rather than very fine dining. But I sort of wonder, given the impact of this pandemic on people's psychology, like where tastes might evolve to. Have you any thoughts on that? And also the risk that restaurateurs, food entrepreneurs, might be willing to take. Because, starting up a restaurant is such a big challenge and it's so much outlay, like you just mentioned with Perry's new thing. What do you think about the next kind of step? Like when we do reopen, what are there any trends that you think might that we might see?
Look, I think one of the things about fine dining, that period you mentioned, 2010, 2011, which is really the peak of the celebrity chef. You had World's 50 Best, etc., were getting going, and you had marquee chefs, you know, like the Adria brothers. You had Rene Redzepi's, the Massimo Bottura's, etc. And this was really the amount of money behind those, not just the restaurants, but more the say the World's 50 Best. The Michelin Guide, etc., the amount of money and sponsorship that was behind them and the amount of publicity that they generated and garnered, this is what was really driving the fine dining industry. And gradually that was sort of seen as an elite construct, and basically we're feeding the 1%, you know, and it was elitist. And I think the zeitgeist has moved on, and what's happened with the pandemic is, again, it's shown into sharp relief what went before, and I guess the degree of elitism in our industry, etc. And I think going forward, we're looking to lower cost economic models that are actually sustainable, because one of the things that the customer is, I think, alluding to your question before, was that customers are not willing to pay above a certain amount. They see, to a certain extent, restaurants as a social service in a way, and there's a price that they're willing to pay for that, and that price is not enough for businesses to be sustainable. So the trend going forward is that, I guess, as competition drops away, you're going to go into a two-tiered system where you're going to have the higher-end restaurants are going to feed basically an elite clientele, your business, you know, your 1%, your top 2%, whatever, and the rest will be everyday restaurants, which are going to have to be proved essential to their public in their offering and at the price point.
One of the things I'm really fascinated about is in the past year, and this will feed directly into how this all looks when restaurants do manage to get open, whenever that is, but input prices have been going up, so particularly meat prices. So we had Tobin Gorey on from the Commonwealth Bank a few months ago, which was a really interesting show. We were talking us through global food prices. But beef prices are very, very high.
Yeah, I've got some numbers here for you, Paul, if you want some.
Yeah, shoot.
That's just come through. So Rural Bank dropped. This will take half a minute. Don't I? Rural Bank, who I follow for cattle prices for our cows that we got down in Victoria, just sort of noticed some things. Australian cattle prices continued to increase during July. Tighter supply and firmer demand was still providing support to the market. The Eastern Young Cattle Indicator, which is the one we follow, rose by 5.9% from the start of the month, with 1,004. Yeah, mate, it's a 6% month. It's bizarre. Well, it's not bizarre. It's exactly the way that we think it's going to be. 1,004 cents per kilo in mid-July. Wetter month in Eastern Australia contributed to higher price growth. Heavy steers, yada, yada, yada. Western cattle don't care about that. So look, that was just the cattle blurb on that one. So beef prices, go carry on, Paul.
So Mark, so you're running a restaurant, right? You have your, you know, your ingredients that you need to get in, but consumers have certain expectations around price, right? So to what extent do restaurants just have to eat it? If you'll pardon the expression, I didn't mean that. I'm really sorry.
It's just the dad joke hour.
Yeah. But to what extent do they just have to take that on? But because, to my mind, you know, there's a certain price that, you know, you expect a decent steak at, and probably something like $40, you know, unless you're at a higher end place where there's a big, big beef menu and you're willing to go up to Wagyu's, etc. But to what extent do restaurants just have to take that on the chin when it happens?
Well, the cost of goods is something that you have to take on, you have to work into your menu, but there is that psychological limit for the consumer, like if whether you talk about depending where it is, which suburb, you know, which demographic it's feeding. I mean, whether you're the $30 main, the $40 main, the $50 or the $60, or you're into the higher end restaurants where you can perhaps have marquee brands of beef, Ranges Valley or something, you know, out of Wagyu out of Japan, etc., where you can perhaps charge a cost plus model, at least get something back. But the issue is that not only the restaurateurs, but going back even through to the suppliers and through to the producers, no one's making any margin. Like right down the chain. I mean, I work with a lamb brand, and it's a brand new brand, and we're trying to break into the market. It's extremely difficult to charge what is required once, you know, you get from the abattoir and transport costs and through to the suppliers and then added costs there, and you know, we're barely able to break even on that. Wow. And even those prices are too much for most restaurants, because they are capped by the psychological limit that they feel that their customers will pay for continued custom. So it's become increasingly difficult to maintain the same product at that price point. And I think what's going to happen is the consumers are going to have to, I think, the trending towards less restaurants, which I think is probably a good thing, because competition is what's keeping the price down. Mm. And certainly I think that we need probably a grade of cost of entry into the industry as well, which is going to mean a certain type of restaurant where it's going to be, you know, big money. So the smaller, more interesting places are going to become less prevalent in the market.
Well, that's noted. Anything on plant-based that you're seeing, Mark, through there? Just on the input pressures that are on beef, along with the ethical the situation that's there. If you've got anything at all, any insight into the plant-based phenomenon, mate, I'm all ears on it too, because there's a few investments out there that depend
plant,
on it.
Plant-based replacement?
Yes.
Meat replacement products.
Yes.
I don't see them making any inroads whatsoever into the industry at the moment. Plant-based, I'm seeing still a huge demand for livestock in terms of beef, lamb, pork, etc. I don't see any waning demand in terms of the customer there. There's a natural suspicion for meat replacement products, especially some of the more technical ones out of the US, in terms of what's in them. The customers certainly are very, very happy to take up a plant-based menu, but things like organic and I guess knowledge of the supply chain back to the grower are very important to chefs and their customer base. So they want to eat vegetables out of the ground and know where they came from and what goes into that ground. That's the most important thing. So seeing soy-based or synthesized products coming out of the US, you know, backed by Bill Gates, is not really helping either.
You're speaking my language there, Mark. Just like this whole thing, I just, you know, asking for a steak and okay, well, we'll bring you out a surprise. You know,
but what about the vegetable revolution? Is not the revolution, but I think that just having a menu that is more vegetarian or doing more interesting things with vegetables is. I am seeing it as being it's a nice change, and I think that it's got somewhere to go. I mean, I love a steak as much as the next man, but
well, look, some of the great cuisines in the world are vegetarian. Look at out of India, China, etc. Just as two of the biggest. So you know, there's so much to do, and it's so interesting, so inventive. I don't see it as replacing beef or lamb or pork, etc. I just see it as a more diverse and interesting restaurant scape.
Will surely be interesting. One of the things, Mark, that has been really interesting and a huge feature of the restaurant industry is how many of the people in Australia, in the Australian industry, come from overseas. And obviously, in the last year, borders have been closed, right? So, you know, there's been a lot of talk. Obviously, we touched on it earlier, but about labor shortages in the hospitality industry. And we heard a bit of that. Obviously, it's been a huge thing in the United States, but when we heard bits and pieces of it around Sydney when things opened up in the first half of this year. A complex question for you, I suppose. But what do you think can be done in terms of a policy level over the next few years to try and make sure that there's a strong, healthy hospitality industry into the future? Because obviously it's not just important for those of us who live here, but people coming from overseas, certainly one of the great surprises, I think, is the diversity and quality of Australian cuisine, you know, wherever you go around the country. So what do you think you'd like to see at a policy level? You know, immigration, whether it's taxes, whether it's other things that government can do to at all levels to help support a great restaurant industry going forward.
You like to pack it in, don't you, mate? look, the biggest thing was seeing the shortage, the labour shortage in the industry. The first thing that people did, especially towards the right-leaning my right-leaning colleagues, were to call into question the fact that we're closing the borders, and what they're looking for, especially the bigger operations, is a low-cost workforce. But what you're seeing around the world, if we're stopping chefs coming in because of our immigration policies, but why is the same problem happening in the US, the same problem happening in the UK, France, etc.? I mean, my colleagues around the world are all crying the same thing, and I think it's just the fact that a lot of it is about the zeitgeist has sort of moved on, and people that sort of that MasterChef effect that is waning. So you had competition vastly outstripping supply, and no one was putting money into training. So going forward, I would like to see the government put enormous money into the training system. We've got our TAFE system, which is basically the only one, is completely broken and inept. It doesn't go anywhere near meeting the needs of the industry, especially the restaurant industry.
Really?
No, it's absolutely hopeless. The base level that they're working at is not even close to what the industry requires. They don't come out a bit like to see some sort of system like perhaps if you're looking at upper end restaurants like in America, the CIA, Culinary Institute of America, is fantastic, putting out quality candidates. The French are extremely good with their cooking schools as well. The UK, not so much. But basically, you've got to be careful to not conflate the labour shortages with people wanting just a low-cost workforce, and those requiring quality candidates to fill their kitchens. They're very different ideas.
Yeah. So, can you talk about some of the specific skills that need to be developed that you don't see from people leaving the TAFE system?
Yeah, I'd really love some detail on that if you've got something, Mark.
So, the TAFE system basically trains people to a very, very basic level. So then there were other bodies came in that were Billy Blue, the Cordon Bleu, et cetera, even the Cordon Bleu, which was a very, very expensive course that people could put their kids through, especially out of places like Singapore. There were, a lot. There were big Cordon Bleu made big inroads there. Those young chefs coming out of there, even if they said they're a Cordon Bleu chef, basically they would come to me and I'd say, well, that's fantastic, but you're basically starting at the bottom.
Yeah.
And so what we need is a hell of a lot more vocational investment so that we can reach a degree of skill in the craft that people can basically hit the ground running. The apprenticeship scheme that I went through, I was an electrician and then I was a chef and I did two apprenticeships. And I think that the apprenticeships system is completely broken since then I guess that's the amount of investment in TAFE meeting a lot of the wage accord in terms of apprentices sometimes earning more money than some of your senior chefs.
Yeah.
Which is just through the wage system. And so restaurants were unable to afford apprentices because they were no longer able to afford to training. They started at a very low level and apprentices actually cost a lot of money because they're just not efficient. It takes a long time to get a worker up to speed and up to efficiency in an operation. And again, I'm not advocating that we go back to, indentureships where people were paid next to nothing, which, I remember starting at $160 a week at McClay Street. Mm-hmm. But I was, 25 years old and that was even difficult even then, and I had to work on the side as an electrician. And since then, that was in the late 80s. I mean, Sydney, obviously living in Sydney, is now almost impossible. At least we could have share housing, et cetera, then, but that's not even an option anymore. So even with restaurants paying their staff a very good minimum wage, is that a livable wage in Sydney or Melbourne or other urban environments? No, it's not. So that's the issue. Yeah. I don't know how you solve that.
It's certainly very tough, and definitely the cost of living is a major factor, particularly in a city like Sydney. Before we go on, a quick word from our sponsor. Our sponsor at the moment is Brookside Energy, an exciting ESG-focused ASX-listed oil and gas company. Record high oil and gas prices, an existing solid production base, and the first of over 20 planned wells about to come on production make Brookside Energy a compelling story. Back to our conversation. Mark, one thing I just want to think about, we're doing a bit of crystal ball gazing here, I suppose.
Yeah.
I touched on a little bit earlier, but it's about customers. And, I just wanted to maybe talk about city economies. We've seen this huge drop off in visitors to CBDs. Melbourne is apparently a ghost town, which makes me really sad. I love, strolling around Melbourne and finding somewhere good to eat and drink in an evening. Even back here in Sydney, at the peak after Sydney reopened, the footfall and transport data showed numbers of people coming into the city were about 30% lower than they were before. And I just wonder about that thing of, you know, if the dining economy can provide the same diversity and quality of those economies of scale, you know, the whole thing, people walking in off the street, and it certainly wouldn't have applied to Mark. But, you know, at the higher end waiting list for bookings, you know, the hard to get seats at tables. If populations in CBDs are smaller than in the past, what will the impacts be?
Well, basically the operations will close. So the restaurant industry and bars and hospitality industry is extremely good at responding and quickly responding to, I guess, market forces and demographic changes. And so the CBD is now basically responding to the fact that many of the large office towers are only now partially populated with so many people working from home, and maybe a lot of them unlikely to return to full capacity. And you're also doubling that up with the complete death of the tourism, overseas tourism. So there's no longer the demand in the CBD. But what we're seeing popping up is, I guess, suburban restaurants as people are working from home and staying within their municipalities, is that the suburban restaurant, the rise and rise of the suburban restaurant and even regional restaurants. We talked about the cost of living in urban environments. What you've seen is a lot of kids, a lot of young people that have returned to their hometowns and propping up the hospitality operations in their hometowns, and they're unlikely to return. And I've spoken to even my friends, good friend in Los Angeles, who said exactly the same thing, that, you know, with COVID and all the strife in Los Angeles, that a lot of people have just returned to their hometowns in Kansas, etc., and unlikely to come back. I mean, the sort of those urban environments have just lost their luster. And I think the same is happening with in Sydney and Melbourne, that we're unlikely to see that continued influx of young people as they get to understand and love the country environment and where they've come from.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? We had a guy on from San Francisco as a guest, but Ben Eifert, he runs a quant fund a few weeks ago. And he was saying he's in downtown San Francisco, and he was saying the area is just dead. Even though, you know, people are vaccinated, you know, the U.S. has done a good job of, you know, in, you know, Delta notwithstanding, it's done a really good job of managing to get to some kind of semblance of normal life in terms of freedoms and restrictions, but the downtown San Francisco is dead, and I just can't imagine that being good for the restaurant industry. You know, it's going to be really tough. And I think, you know, that whole thing of you were talking about earlier, 10 years ago, you know, restaurants feeding the 1%. If there are smaller numbers of high quality restaurants, they're going to be harder to get into for the number of people who still want those kind of experiences. You know, if you take, you know, call it 20-30% of them out, there's not that many of them anyway, you know. So the tables are going to get more and more exclusive and hard to get to.
I think it's like, I don't know about you, but I think I feel that at times like this, there are more important things that are on our mind. And I think that is in the general public as well, that you know, having Hunger Games for the best tables is just not top of mind anymore. I think things have changed and things have moved on. Whether that will recover is another thing. I think that we're in a cycle where things are going to become what you've seen with these troubled times, the rise of nativism, etc., that, you know, people are just turning to their home and hearth and a different outlook on life, etc.
And, you know, maybe we can lighten the mood a little bit, but just heading towards just during lockdown, what are you cooking? What do you enjoy doing at the moment?
I enjoy doing at the moment.
Food-wise.
Look, I've never cooked so much at home in all my life. I mean, obviously, cooking in restaurants and cooking at home are in the entirely different disciplines. So I really actually enjoy cooking at home and just cooking very simple, nutritious stuff. And, I've never lost my love of cooking. Running restaurants maybe put a bit of a lid on the passion, but that was the small business side of it. As a small business operator, can often get in the way of your passion for the craft.
So you've rediscovered it a little bit, do you think?
Yeah, I think the last 5 years I've just really re-engaged with cooking intrinsically and just the craft of it. You know, I've been baking croissants at home and sourdough bread like everyone else, and fermenting and making my own vinegars, and you know, so yeah, it's just interesting. You know, I love it. So I come from a long line of Brozzavelli cooks going back to Poland in the 1860s. So I have that in my blood.
And you must be loving the seafood prices at the moment.
I think that seems expensive. my wife Valerie is she's in a bodybuilding competition, so she's been eating. She can only eat white fish at night. So I've been I costed it out that her bar cod is $25 a portion. So I've been eating the cheaper cut, so I can afford it.
What are your favourite things to cook at the moment?
Just in terms of dinners, always the classic roast chicken is always a favourite. I tend to like to get the blowtorch out and shrink the skin and dry it out and get it super crispy, and then I spray it with one of those olive oil sprays, and so I can just coat it with this Japanese sprinkle, which is chili and sesame and dried garlic and onions over the top. It's absolutely delicious.
And do you stuff it with anything?
No, I don't stuff it. Stuffing just sort of slows down the cooking process for me. So if I'm going to make a stuffing, I'll cook it separately.
Right. What about the fish? What do you serve those up with?
I've been enjoying just roasting a lot of things from the brassica family. So, you know, like even broccolinis or broccoli or cauliflower or different cabbages, Brussels sprouts. Again, just with flaked Korean chili and just roasting that in a hot oven, serving that with the steamed fish. It's absolutely delicious. Just, I guess this is purity of the flavour and the caramelisation of the sugars in those little cabbages are just amazing. So it's just a different way of cooking things.
Yeah, fantastic. And I heard somewhere that you've got a knife that's made out of a meteorite. Is that true?
It's in the past tense. I tried to do something stupid with it.
Oh, no.
And because it was so hard, it shattered into 1,000 pieces.
What?
Which is sort of nice in a way. Yeah. Given it's sort of nice in that it came from a meteorite, so now that it's in 1,000 pieces, I think it's continued on its journey.
When you say you tried to do, can you go into detail of what you did with it?
I've embarrassed myself. Yeah.
Right.
I used it as a lever on something in a bone, and it just that cross leverage just made it shatter into 1,000 pieces.
Goodness me.
It was a rookie error, and I would have beat anyone else to death with the handle that had done it. But you know, I had to give myself a pass.
Brilliant. So speaking of rookie errors, tell me one or two of the things you really hate to see people doing when they're cooking food.
Oh, it's such a long list. Look, I think the internet is where good recipes go to die. I've always basically taught on principle rather than recipes. So people are addicted to recipes. One of the things I think is that people tend to cook a recipe once and then move on to another recipe, and it's just really not the way that you increase your skill level. You become increasingly addicted to the possibility of a new recipe with a lesser result. So the best things you'll notice that cooks do is when they cook something repeatedly, which I guess replicates the process of a professional chef who, you know, perhaps will cook something 1,000 times. Yeah, you know, so it's no wonder that you're good at it. So it's a bit like playing the guitar or the piano. So the more you do it, the hand memory, etc., just comes into it, gives that sort of fluency.
Yeah, certainly very interesting. Thank you for
And having said that, if I ever see another fucking Ottolenghi salad anywhere, it'll be too soon.
You're confirming my prior as well, because I have a few staples, you know, that I'll just try to make sure that I, you know, try to find things that I can't F up and learn to do them well rather than being wildly experimental.
Stop flipping the steak. Leave the steak alone.
So this is the thing. Now James had to pop off, and I'm absolutely devastated that he's not here for this.
Is he a flipper?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So when we were talking with Tobin Gorey about steaks, James said, and I have sledged him a couple of times on the show since, right, about this, that he started turning his steaks four times. After he had some conversation with an Argentinian or some South American, he said, yeah, give it a minute once this, and then a minute on the other side, and then a minute on the other side, and then one more minute on the other side. And I was horrified by this. So can you please tell me how wrong he is?
Poor James, he's not here to defend himself, but he's 100% wrong. I will cook it on one side the most. We even had so the thinner the steak, the more you cook it on one side to get the caramelization. We even used to serve thin slivers of Wagyu that we would only cook it on one side. So we'd put it straight onto the hot plate, which was running at about 1,000 degrees, and cook it literally for seconds on there, but only one side be raw on the other. So in that way, you can get the caramelization, which is what it's all about. So when you start flipping it, the first time you flip it, already you've rendered the interior into the realms of mystery. No one knows what happens after that. So if you're cooking it one side down, at least you can see the raw side. You can see how the heat is rising up through the steak. And basically, you cook it all on one side, and you can view the cooking temperature, the strata of the temperatures that rises through it. And then you just flip it over and just maybe 20% of the cooking time on the second side.
It's music to my ears, and I'm genuinely
devastated. That applies to everything: fish, lamb chops, you name it. Applies to everything.
Oh, really? Yeah. So just watch the flesh starting to cook on the bottom, and
yeah.
Then...
So obviously, you moderate your temperatures. Even if you're cooking a piece of salmon on the skin, you just cook it on the skin almost the entire way, and perhaps for the final 15 seconds flip it over just to seal the other side.
Yeah, right. If you were cooking a steak, this is my last question for you, if you were cooking a steak at home, like a decent grass-fed steak or whatever, how would you prepare it? Would you do much to it?
Always just usually Murray River salt, plenty of it. I can guess it now. I've got measuring eyes after all this time, but for your consumer, 2% is the figure. So if you've got a 1 kilo steak, you need to put 20 grams of sugar, 20 grams of salt onto it.
Wow!
So 2% is the magic percentage where we perceive that things are well seasoned. Try it in anything.
Oh wow! I've got to do that. Yeah,
you're going to do that. So even potatoes, but if you if you got water with your potatoes, you have to include the total weight of all ingredients, right?
Right.
You got it?
Yep.
So anyway, so if I get a lovely piece of steak, currently I'm in love with retired dairy steaks, which are fantastic. And so, you know, get a big steak, plenty of salt, and I season it. And again, this is going to blow James's mind. I season it way ahead of time, maybe up to 2 hours ahead, which will be contrary to his belief systems, I'm sure. And what that does is basically it's like a dry brine. So basically the salt starts to penetrate the steak and season it. And it gives a really well-rounded seasoning to it. And it draws out some of the proteins onto the surface, which allows it to caramelize better and easier.
I think I'm going to have to try this tonight.
And then I, if I'm cooking a big fat steak like that, I love my little green egg, which I use at hardwood charcoal. So just that smoke and that flame is absolutely perfect.
Right, and you do this on the barbecue, so you have your little green egg. You get that going beforehand, or
why I love those, that type of barbecue is even like a Weber, is that you can control the flame. So even if it's got a lot of fat on it, it's basically an oxygen-starved environment, so it stops it flaming up. You don't want the flame; you just want the heat from the coals and the smoke from when the fat drips on the coals flavoring it. You don't want any flame at all, because that's when it tastes, you know, almost like a petroleum-like after flavor.
Fantastic. I think I'm ready for
ready?
Yeah. I'm ready to go.
If I could just teach one person one thing at a day, I mean, I'm happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, this has been fantastic. And it's great to, after what I think was pretty worrying conversation, it's a serious topic. Food is very important to all of us, and I think some of our favorite moments in life are around a table.
Mine too. 100%. But you know, you're talking about an industry in crisis, and so it's hard to have happy conversations all the time.
Yeah, and it's good to be able to have frank conversations, and also great to have, you know, somebody who's been so successful and is such a great standard bearer for the industry as well. Mark, it's been great having you on.
I just want to sort of be an advocate for for truth. You know, we see so many people going into the industry, and it's good that they're excited and they're following a passion for food wherever that came from, but I want them to go into it with a more of a pragmatic mindset and actually have sat down and done a business plan that they adhere to. And I would like to see less attrition in the industry, and you know, the money there, and it's usually their personal savings that are going into other people's pockets, and I want to see less of that.
Yeah, and no doubt. And I think you know, the sake of the industry, like, we've been so blessed in Australia to have all these different influences come together. And I know anytime I go home to Ireland after about 10 days, I start really wanting the taste of, like, citruses and, you know, lemon in my food again, you know, like all that fresh Australian stuff that we get, and we've been so lucky, and you know, to make sure that this all of that offering is can come to life again once we eventually get things going back in the same direction. I think it's going to need a lot of input and a lot of leadership from people. And like you say, you know, people being pragmatic and open-eyed about the challenges with running restaurants.
Look, the thing is that the restaurant industry the restaurant industry itself, like as an idea, is not in crisis. It's always going to be here. The crisis is whether the people involved now will be part of it. And that's the restaurant industry, and that will always respond to the market, whatever it is, whenever that is. There will be some form, but you know, it's just, we're trying to, the difficulty is now is the people that involved now, whether they will be part of the future, and that's where the crisis is.
This has been a terrific conversation. Just a reminder that this season of the BIP Show is brought to you by Brookside Energy, one of the most exciting sustainable growth oil and gas companies listed on the ASX. For investors wanting exposure to rising oil and gas prices, the stock code is BRK. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate us and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on iTunes at The BIP Show or wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Twitter. It's at @_BIP_show. And we're on Facebook too. Just search The BIP Show. James has a website which is now hosting all the extras we can't get to on the show, including a few trades and positions. Just Google Whelan Capital, follow the links to The BIP Show. We're also there individually at Colgo, at James Whelan 42, and you can find Mark at MarkBest, one word. He's, like I mentioned earlier, got a whole bunch of diverse interests, really interesting guy to follow, can't recommend it highly enough. So again, don't forget to hit subscribe and rate the show. We love those five-star ratings. And Mark Best, thank you so much for making the time to come on and talk about this. It's been great chatting with you.
It's my pleasure. And sorry, James, for being disparaging about your tongue skills, mate. But
he's back.
I can't believe I've just managed to pop back in just to hear that apparently I've been absolutely trash-talked on this one. Four turns. It'll change your life. 30 seconds each. Keep it low cooked. It's got to be an interest taker.
You stick to your wheelhouse, mate. I'm the expert in this case.
Fair enough, mate. Absolutely. Look, I can't wait to listen back to see how you recommended that I do cook my steak, and I'll do that with a big glass of Shiraz pretty soon. Okay.
Very good. Lovely to meet you.
And you too. Thanks very much, mate.
Cheers. Thanks.
Great talking. The show is produced by Rick Salter. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.